I want to say from the outset that I am not an economist. I do have a degree in public policy that includes enough economics to at least make me think that I can understand certain things. But the debt crisis was something that I started becoming more and more interested in probably 6-7 years ago. And particularly when I was here on the staff at Holden, became more and more concerned that it's, I think, probably as crucial an issue as we face in the world, because it just pervades all through the world in terms of its daily effects on people's lives. And yet very few people in the church especially really have any understanding about what it is, and there are not very many opportunities to really learn about the debt crisis and to try to make some sense out of it. So I began trying to put together some resources that or doing some sessions that perhaps could help us out in that way. I feel very strongly that economics, like some other professions, has been a profession that economists have sort of guarded in some ways through their terminology, through their sort of way of setting themselves apart. With the attitude that other people can't understand this, you have to leave it to the economist. And I think that it's basically every justice issue eventually becomes somehow or another related to economics. And it's time for people who are not economists to take responsibility for understanding some basic economics, and also saying that we don't have to be economists to have some sensitivity to these issues. So, with that as an introduction, let's take a look at what the debt crisis is. And I think, hopefully you all got the announcement that the idea today would be to do this for an hour and a half. And maybe somewhere in the middle, if people get tired, we can take a quick stretch. But obviously, we really need about 5 hours, but we're going to try to do what we can. It's the kind of thing that I couldn't do in a series without knowing that the people who came the second time were who have been here the first time. So we're just going to try to do what we can in an hour and a half and go from there. What my idea for the time would be is just to start with, what is the debt crisis itself? Just a little bit about the parameters of it. What caused it, looking a little bit at the background. Up until the 1970s, the 1970s was when the foundation of the problem was set, and then in the 1980s is when we really start identifying the crisis, and then looking at what the real direct causes are from the early 1980s. Just very briefly, who's responsible for it, because that's one of the primary issues of who's going to now take care of it, who's going to pay for it. Looking then a little bit at the IMF, or the International Monetary Fund. If anything you read on the debt crisis is going to have the IMF all through it. Then looking a little bit about the human cost, some on proposed solutions, FLIC, which is financial low intensity conflict. Those of you who've done anything in Central America or in other places know that the United States, one of our policies, openly stated policies, is called low-intensity conflict. That's in a military sense. A lot of people are now saying that the debt crisis is another form of low-intensity conflict that's in the financial sense. Very briefly, if we have some time, just looking a little bit at the effects in the United States of the debt crisis. And we should say from the outset, the United States is the largest debtor nation in the world. But the IMF doesn't do a whole lot to us. And then a little bit at resources, and maybe I should say resources and action. Perhaps I should just say from the beginning too that we're not going to have a lot of time to look at specifically what we can do about it. And I do want to talk about that. Basically what I want to do is point you in the direction of some organizations that are monitoring the debt crisis and are involving people. And frankly, since I've been in Central America, I'm not sure exactly now what specifically legislatively is going on in the United States. And I haven't had a chance to check that out since I've been here. So in terms of some specifics in that, it would almost be better to contact some other people, and I hope some of you will do that. But we can talk briefly, too, about about some ways of responding. This session is going to be more my talking than probably other sessions that I do and the way I like to do it, but I would encourage people to ask questions at any point. And don't hesitate, please, because if you don't, for part of this, if you miss one part, the other part may not make sense. So we'll take whatever time we need to clarify. And then we can see what time we have at the end. There's plenty of other things that we can go into more detail about. All right. Starting with what is it? First of all, we just need to define some terms. The external debt is simply the idea of what a government, usually in this case, or private businesses owe to other governments or other banks, other businesses outside of their country. That's the external debt. And that's primarily what we're dealing with now. We're not really talking about a bank in Bolivia loaning money to a farmer in Bolivia. We're talking about what a government or a business owes to international banks outside of Bolivia or to other governments. The principle, and most of you can probably answer this, is very basic. If you have a loan out, what's the principle? It's the original amount that you have borrowed, or if you paid some other principal, it's the basic amount that you would have to pay off at any one moment to cancel the loan. The interest is the charge that you pay in order to have that loan. So if I borrow $10 from someone in this room and I agree to pay 10% interest compounded hourly, every hour I'm going to have to pay $1 in interest. But as long as I just pay a dollar, what's the principal going to still be? It's still going to be $10. And that's very important because that's half the problem in the debt crisis right now. Okay? But if I pay $2 one hour, my principal would be $9 and I would still be paying on interest. Okay? There, just very briefly, this isn't all that crucial, but for some of it, it helps explain something. The difference between nominal and real interest. Nominal interest is what the stated interest is. If I say I'm going to pay 10% interest on something, the nominal interest is 10%. But let's say that I'm going to pay 10% interest each year on something and the inflation rate is 4%. What's my real interest rate? It's going to be 6%. Because the value of the money that I pay in a year will be 4% less valuable. All right, so I'm actually paying less. If I pay $100 this year on something, and a year from now, after inflation of 4%, that $100 is not worth as much as it was a year ago. Okay, so in some ways what I'm really paying is only 6% interest in real terms, in terms of what I can get in salaries and other what I have to pay. We can go into that more detail. If you don't quite get that, don't worry, it's not going to be crucial. Export earnings is what someone earns from their export. It's what, and in this case it's going to be what a country earns. It's the total amount in one year that a country brings in by exporting things. So if we were a nation right here and we were producing knitted goods and we only have one worker right now producing, which is not going to be very good for our economy, but anyway, and we sent those out and we sold them, and that was the only thing that we had, maybe we exported Bibles or something, the total amount that we bring in terms of earning, what we profit from, is going to be our export earnings. The IMF, I've already said, is the International Monetary Fund. We'll talk more about that in a minute. Capital flight is very important, too. Capital flight is the amount of money that goes out of a country by private people or businesses. For instance, again, if we're a country here and I don't know your name, but you have a factory and you're producing knitted goods, and you're making a lot of money off the rest of us who you're really exploiting and paying almost nothing. Okay, instead of, very often what happens in the third world is instead of her investing back into this economy, she's going to take all of her profit and send it off to Switzerland and put it in a private bank or put it in somewhere in the United States or invest in the United States where that money will probably bring her a better reward. And also she's going to protect it because maybe where we live right now in this country is not very stable, and who knows whether the guerrillas are going to take over or not. And they may just take all of your factories away from you. So you're going to make sure that you've got your little stash somewhere. Now what that does is that obviously this economy is not going to benefit at all from the labor or in the long run and the labor going on. So that's capital flight, is when people take their money and take it outside of the country and put it somewhere else. A lot of countries have laws, very strict laws, about how much you can take out, but people still find ways of getting it out. And commodities and cash crops are crops like, does anybody know what they might be?
Coffee.
Coffee is a big one. Sugar. Cotton to some degree.
Macadamia nuts.
Macadamia nuts. They're crops that are grown not for food for the people in that country, but primarily to export to bring in income. And again, that's a crucial piece of the puzzle.
Would timber be, in this case, from our country as well?
I'm not sure if timber would be considered a cash crop. It probably would be, but in terms of the debt crisis, it's not going to be one that would normally be used. Yeah. Okay, let's look at...
What are commodities then?
They're the same thing. I mean, basically, commodities are the, you know, tobacco is another thing. Okay, let me just... All right, so what is the debt crisis? I mean, we've probably heard, some of us I'm sure have heard different degrees or different levels of information about it. I always want to start by just reading a couple little brief quotes. Number one, just to say, I live in Central America, and it's not as much talked about in El Salvador because our dear government sends so much military aid down there that it helps sort of balance out things. But if you go to Nicaragua right now, I mean, this was in the paper just a couple months ago, the Nicaragua owes $514 million. That's just to the World Bank. I'm sorry, wait a minute. Now that's what they paid. I'm sorry, they owe $9 billion. And if you know anything about Nicaragua, I mean, the economy's just in shambles. There's a lot of reasons for that. Some of it has to do with the debt. Here's another thing. I was in Guatemala not too long ago, and there's another article here about the IMF arriving in Guatemala. And there are quotes in here from labor leaders saying, you know, these people are here just to impose restrictions on our economy that are going to hurt the people in this country, 85% of which are poor. 85% of the population of Guatemala is considered to be in advanced poverty. Or this is an article written by somebody who works in Bolivia, and this is the last two paragraphs. In the long run, children are the most affected by Bolivia's debt. Statistics tell the story. 6 infants under 1 year of age die every hour in Bolivia. Infant mortality has increased. Now, this is really important. We're not talking about just things not developing in the third world. We're talking about the fact that in the last 10 years, things have gotten a lot worse. Okay? Infant mortality has increased from 150 per 1,000 births in 1972 to 231 per 1,000 births. This was written in 1989. 50% of Bolivian children do not survive to 10 years of age. Those who do survive are often plagued by learning difficulties due to malnutrition they suffered at an early age. Although the foreign debt cannot be blamed for all the ills that confront the marginalized people of Bolivia, probably no other single economic factor can explain the worsening of the quality of life in Bolivia and other Latin American countries. Here's a quote from a theologian from Rock Hollow who says, "There is no chance of development in Latin America as things stand. The external debt has for a number of years entirely blocked the possibility of overall economic development in underdeveloped countries." Latin Americans often refer to the 1980s as the lost decade, where advances in their economic strength in the 60s and 70s primarily were just completely wiped out. Henry Kissinger, of all people, even admits that it will never be able to be paid. Okay, we have a situation in which in the developing countries of the world, or the two-thirds world, whatever term we want to use, in 1970 the total external debt was $18 billion. In 1983, it was $810 billion, and in 1987, it crossed the $1 trillion mark. So that in, 16 years, it has gone from $18 billion to $1 trillion. That's the kind of magnitude we're talking about. Brazil owes about, these have changed a little bit. These figures are from 4 or 5 years ago. Brazil's is now around 90, I think, billion. But these figures haven't, the overall principle hasn't changed a whole lot, unfortunately. But in 1986, Brazil owed $108 billion, Mexico $102 billion. You can look all the way down here. And in Central America, Panama, $25 billion. Now, probably the most important figure, though, is the debt service ratio. What that is simply the percentage of one's export earnings that you have to pay each year just to service the debt, which is just to pay the interest. It's not even counting paying off on the principal. Okay? So if my debt service ratio, let's say that I have, that in our country here, that we have a debt of $100 billion, and my debt service ratio is 50%, that means that we're paying half of what we earn by our exports every year just to pay our interest. Okay, does that make sense to people?
Yeah. I just want to clarify, these are debts to other countries, mm-hmm. right? What happens if do you have a case where one country owes an incredible amount to country A, owes to country B? Does country B ever owe to country A and they cancel each other?
Well, most of these countries don't owe money to each other. They owe money to Western, European, okay. U.S. banks for the most part, and some to governments. In Latin America, it's about two-thirds of the debt, total debt, goes to private commercial banks, and about one-third are loans that have come from governments. In Africa, it's just the reverse. It's two-thirds that have come from governments and about one-third that have come from commercial banks. But there may be in here, and I frankly don't know. I mean, there may be situations in here. I'm sure that there are businesses in Brazil that somehow or another have a loan from a bank in Argentina. I mean, that would make sense. But I think that the amount would be pretty negligible compared to what one would owe to
So usually it's third world countries owing to
right.
Western.
Exactly.
And
yeah.
Who do we owe to?
Who does the United States owe to? We owe to...
not these countries.
No, we don't. I mean, we have Japan. A lot of foreign investments from Europe, from Japan, okay. from other...
It's conceivable that we could owe some money to individuals in some of these countries. Mm-hmm. The 15%, for example, who own, or the 10% from the other day, who own 60 or 80% of the land. They, if they're
in El Salvador, right.
In El Salvador, or, yeah. or any of the other Latin American countries, or third world countries, the wealthy have to have somewhere to put their money.
Right.
U.S. Treasury bonds are one of the most highly sought after and safest investments that anybody can make in the world, and they duly make those. They buy those U.S. Treasury
bonds. And a lot of the capital flight that we were just talking about could go to buy those.
Right. They don't buy their own government bonds.
Right. No.
They don't buy their corporate bonds from corporations in their own country. They buy U.S. Treasury bonds.
Right.
And a lot of Japanese do that too.
Yes. No, No, that's a good point. That's a good question.
Yeah.
Okay, so let's just take a quick look at here, just in terms of the magnitude of the problem. Brazil owes in interest, just interest, 53% of what it earns every year in its exports. Okay? Mexico is 44%, Argentina 48%, I think it's supposed to be 10%, Indonesia, Venezuela is 24, Philippines 23, Nigeria 12, Chile is 44%, although Central American Panama is 46.2% of its export earnings. Yes.
Generally speaking, what is the money from, or what do they borrow, or what does this debt represent?
We're gonna get to that if you can hold on to it. Okay. Any other questions about this? Okay. We're gonna get to that right now. All right. So how did this whole thing develop? We'll get to this chart in a few minutes. Is the question. Okay. First of all, to understand the debt crisis, you even have to start back with colonialism. Very briefly, with the idea that when European countries are started colonializing Latin America and Africa, the primary purpose economically for them was to extract resources from those countries and bring them back to their own country. So the agricultural system set up was primarily one of cash crops. Like we talked about yesterday, for those of you who are in the session on El Salvador, or Monday on El Salvador, first it was indigo, then later it was more coffee, sugar, cotton. So that was originally the way things were set up. It's very difficult then to all of a sudden change your economy. That system has come down through the years. And even though there have been some variations in that, and different countries have diversified their economy a little bit, most third world countries are still fairly locked into that kind of system. And part of that system has always been that those prices fluctuate tremendously. They're completely at the sort of at the mercy of the market. And the first world has always refused to stabilize those prices. As always, there have been several attempts to reach some kind of trade agreement where prices on coffee, prices on sugar would be stabilized, or there'd be some kind of system in which people in those countries that are producing those products could know a few years ahead that for the most part those prices are going to fall within this range. But they haven't done that. Obviously it's to our benefit with people who are buying it to be able, if there's a glut in the market, we get it for very, very cheap. What does that do to the economies that are selling it? That all of a sudden there's a fallout in sugar prices, for instance. Then, just very, very briefly mention, you come through colonialism in 1944, you had the Bretton Woods Conference. And that's where the International Monetary Fund and some other organizations were founded. That comes, obviously, near the end of World War II. It was the Allies that had this conference. And basically what they were saying is, this war is going to be over soon. We're going to set up the international monetary, our economic system, really. And obviously, when one does that, they do it to benefit themselves. The International Monetary Fund has essentially close to the same membership as the UN. But it's not one vote per country. Your vote depends on your economic power and some other kind of criteria that was set up originally. The United States has 19% essentially of the voting power in the IMF, even though they're well over 100 member countries. The IMF was set up as sort of to help stabilize and monitor the international economy. It was set up to provide short-range loans or short-term loans to countries that were having balance of payment problems. The reason for that being, if a country is in financial shape and the United States is selling things to them, what's going to happen if that country's in bad shape? We're not going to have a market any longer for our products. So therefore, you set up an agency that provides some short-term loans, try to help them get over the hump, and then we can continue our market does not have to fluctuate as much. So it's a sort of a balancing agency. And in and of itself, it might not necessarily be all that bad. Okay, in the 1940s to 1960s, you had the independence movements in Africa and in Latin America. So a lot of countries become independent of their original colonial powers, or motherland, so to speak. But the colonial structures still remained the same, essentially. Raw materials were still used for export, and there's very little chance, really. I mean, you can't just all of a sudden change your economy and diversify it. But very little was done with that. In the 1960s was the big decade of development. That's when all of a sudden the United States, Western Europe, everyone was going to help develop the world, and I think with really good intentions. But for the most part, what was done, the vision, were very, very large development projects. And going in and we're going to basically transfer North American and Western technology to the third world. And I think most people who look back on that now think that was a big mistake in and of itself in terms of just development, but it also had major consequences for the debt crisis. Because what happened was is that by the late 60s, you had the large banks in the world moving into the third world and enticing them with loans for these large projects. And that started right in the late 60s. I think the figure we had was 1971 here for the first, for $18 billion. Well, I think it was only $9 billion in 1969. So it doubled in 2 years. Because of this sort of momentum going around getting money into development projects. Well, then, one of the crucial factors is in 1973. Does anybody, I mean, anybody who was driving a car in 1973 remember what we had to do to get gasoline? 1973 is the first oil crisis, where OPEC, the oil cartel, jacked up prices overnight. Now, that did two things. They have sort of a reverse effect in some ways, but the most important one is that all of a sudden gave the oil-producing countries a lot of extra money, cash rolling around. Now, if you have a lot of cash, you obviously want to put it somewhere and make more money off of it. So within a year or two, there was a tremendous increase in the amount of cash that oil-producing countries invested in Western and North American banks, primarily at that time. Now, if you're a banker, how do you make money?
Investing it.
If you have a bunch of money sitting in your bank that you're paying interest out on, you're going to lose money if you don't get that money out working for you. Does that make sense, everyone? In other words, people put their money in banks so they can draw interest out of it. And that basically, they're getting paid by the bank for the use of their money. The bank, to make a profit, has to loan that money out at a higher percentage rate than they're paying to other people. And it's the difference in that interest rate, more or less, that is their profit. That's how they make money. So these banks all of a sudden have all this money. Well, if they don't get it out into loans, they're going to start losing money. Having a bunch of money in the bank for a bank is not the way they make money. Banks want to get rid of this money and get it out. And what they do is they lower substantially the standards by which they use for giving out loans. There are all sorts of stories about how young bankers are sent all over the country and go to cocktail parties and talk to military dictators and to people, the finance ministers of small countries, and convince them basically on the spot to borrow, you know, a couple million dollars for some project. So the answer to your questions is, the money went to everything from, supposedly, originally for development projects, for improving the infrastructure of the country, for building roads, for building buildings, for large construction projects. Like, for instance, one of the classic examples is in the Philippines. There's an atomic power plant there that has never been put into production. But I can't remember now how many, I think it's something like $10 billion or $20 billion that they put into that. But now, because it's near a fault line, they can't use it. Mm-hmm. There's also a whole story behind that, because it was built by, there were bids by Westinghouse and by GE, but the bid by, I can't remember which was which, but let's say the bid by GE was half the amount of the bid that originally got it, because Marcos was paid off by the other company to give them the contract. So that essentially the people of the Philippines paid twice as much as they needed to for an atomic power plant that still doesn't work. A lot of it went to military aid. Those were the original intents of a lot of these loans. Where the money really went in a lot of cases was corruption, capital flight. There's a study was done a few years ago by Morgan Guaranty, one of the banks, and basically they came out saying that if there had been no capital flight, Argentina's debt, instead of being $1 billion, would be $1 billion instead of, I think it's $80 billion. If Mexico had had no capital flight, their debt would be $12 billion instead of $100 billion. If the Philippines had had no capital flight, theirs would be $15 billion instead of about $28 billion. That's because of the corruption and people basically, the leading the countries who are the ones responsible for these loans and had the direct access to it, basically taking it off and using it for their own purposes. And there was a lot of money also squandered in military arms and in large projects that really where the money was spent for those projects, but they haven't really ever amounted to much. And a lot of those projects never, even those that were completed, did not contribute to the economic development of the country in most cases. I mean, the idea was is that if you pour in this money, you're going to increase the economic power, and therefore they'll be able to produce more, be able to earn more, pay off the loans, and in the end, everybody will be better off. Well, it never happened that way. It's also interesting to note that one of the favorites of banks for as far as countries to give loans to were the most reactionary military dictatorships, because they were seen as the ones that were the most stable. So there was a real alliance between military dictators and Western banks that were giving out all this money. So in the 1970s, you have all this money that poured in to these countries. Standards were dropped. And then in 1979, we had a second oil crisis. All right. This time, what the primary effect is that the oil prices went up to the degree that there might have been a little bit more money in the banks. At that time, the sort of real peak of loans was over to the third world, but it increased the amount of oil. They increased the oil prices for third world countries significantly. And so they're now at a point where they're having to pay more for imports. It also hit the United States and other Western countries in a way that led to a recession. Because essentially, the United States had to tighten its belt. Inflation was very, very high. If you remember, in 1979, 80, that was one of the big campaign issues between Carter and Reagan, was the amount of inflation. I think it was up to like 18-20% around that time. So the United States took measures to try to lower inflation. Actually, that started before interest rates went up, because interest rates were a result of that. I'm getting ahead of myself. To lower inflation and to keep our own costs down a little bit, because we're having to pay for oil. All right, well, what that does to people with large debts is when you try to lower inflation, usually interest rates go up. Now, one of the key factors I haven't told you is that there's a difference between fixed rate interest and floating rate. Most of the loans that went out to third world countries in the 70s were floating rate loans. They weren't fixed. So they were getting incredible interest rates. There was all this money around. People wanted to get it out. And in some cases, it was at the time that they were loaned, they were actually negative interest rates. In other words, I might get a loan at 7%, but inflation is 8%. So it's like you can't lose. So everybody is like, hey, you know, I mean, yeah, sure, let's take it. Well, all of a sudden, things change because there were fairly low interest rates in the early and mid-70s. By 1979, 80, 81, interest rates have gone sky high. They have to pay those higher interest rates. They're tied to an international interest rate standard called the, there's several. One is the London Interbank Exchange Rate, and there's another one that would be more out of the United States, out of New York. So all of a sudden, people's interest rates, and therefore their debt service, or the amount they have to pay every year, has doubled, tripled, quadrupled in price. At the same time, because of the recession, because the United States and other Western European countries are tightening their belt, if you're tightening your belt, you're not going to buy as much. You're not going to drink as much coffee. You're not going to eat, you're not going to use as much sugar. So what happens to those prices? They plummet. So the third world is caught in double bind. They're having to pay more on their interest rates, they're having to pay more on their oil prices, and they're getting much less for their commodity prices. So let's just to take a look at this real quickly. This is an example of just sugar and cotton. In 1980, the price of sugar was 80 cents to the kilogram. In 1981, it was 25. And then it came on down to a little about 18 in 1982, and it's been relatively stable there. Cotton, around 68, I'm sorry, it's over here, 220 or so cents to the kilogram, and it comes down to about 170 by 1981, and down further goes up a little bit, but now in 1985 it's about 115, it looks like. So from 215 to 115 in 5 years. Yes.
Who sets the prices? Is it the buyer or the seller who sets the price? The buyer.
Mostly the buyer in this case. I mean, it's basically what people are willing to pay for. It's the buyer and the seller. It's a supply and demand kind of thing. But basically, it's important to understand that U.S. monetary policy has had a direct effect on what third world countries have had to pay. That doesn't mean that those policies weren't necessarily, I mean, they might have been good things for the time in some other places, but there needs to be some sense of responsibility that what we have benefited from has also directly affected third world. Yeah.
Where is most of Central Latin America's exports, where are they going? Is it mostly America, mostly Europe, kind of hard to say?
I don't know what the percentages are, but I do know the United States is the primary buyer of throughout Latin America. I do know that, yeah.
Could all the sugar producers say in the third world be together and say, we're going to charge more, like the oil cartel?
There have been attempts, and in fact, I mean, I know more about coffee because El Salvador, there is a coffee, I don't remember what it's called, an international association, and they've attempted that. But basically, there's so much pressure. There's a lot that goes on in the economies there. Basically, people, different countries will get a good deal with a certain, with the United States or with somebody else, and basically they divide and conquer, essentially, so that they never have really been able to stick by having sort of a stabilized price.
It's really just the oil cartel that's done it.
Yeah, because, I mean, we need oil more than we need coffee. Yeah. I mean, that's what amounts. Well, I don't know, some of you may.
Mary, I think another part of that equation with respect to her question, with respect to coffee, from what I understand, is that a lot of times the coffee beans are the product of the third world, and then they have to be processed.
That's right.
And that processing plant may be in the United States or somewhere else, and so that there's a multi-tiered system that mm-hmm. keeps the person at the bottom pretty much subservient, mm-hmm. Because there's either the company that's based in the United States and the processing plant is somewhere else, so they don't have quite the control that the Arabs do with the oil.
Right. Right. I think a lot of times, I mean, coffee in El Salvador is processed in Europe and then ends up coming to the United States after that. Some of it. I don't think it's a large percentage, but some of it. All right, let me just catch up with my notes here and make sure I'm not missing something. Okay, let me just as one more example, to put it sort of in perspective. This is just one example, basically, of what the net cost would be for third world country. Look at the fall in commodity prices. But this is a case between 1976 and 1981 in Tanzania. Basic products are cotton, coffee, cashews, and tobacco. The price for a truck is going to go up a little bit during that time. Probably is relatively stable. I mean, it's not going to be a huge difference. But we already saw that the prices of these commodities have dropped tremendously. So what someone in Tanzania has to produce in 1976 of one unit of cotton, or one unit of coffee, or one unit of cashews, or one unit of tobacco, becomes in 5 years later, they have to produce four times the amount of coffee because the price has dropped, or three times the amount of coffee, or three times the amount of cashews, or 10 times the amount of tobacco. That's the buying power of their crops. In other words, in 5 years, the buying power of cotton has dropped. It has dropped four times, or dropped to one-fourth of its original value. Coffee, one-third, cashews, one-third, and this to one-tenth. That's what they're getting. So, I mean, if you look at, I mean, obviously the way things balance out between what you have to pay to get things in to help develop in your country and what you have to produce to buy those things, I mean, it's pretty clear. It's not a good situation. Okay, so that's basically brings us to the early 80s. And in 1982, basically nobody heard of any debt crisis. This is all going on and developing till 1982, when all of a sudden, I remember hearing this on the news, I don't know if you read it, Mexico is going to go bankrupt. And there was this big, huge crisis of what we're going to do, and they have all these loans from Western banks, and what's going to happen if they go bankrupt. I mean, in the 1970s, people were saying, hey, we can't lose on giving money to governments. The head of Chase Manhattan, or Citicorp, I think, said, we can't lose on giving money to governments because they can't go bankrupt. A nation can't go bankrupt. Well, all of a sudden, they were changing their tune. So that's where we come to in terms of really what the background of the debt crisis is. And that's when we started calling it a debt crisis. We'll talk a little bit more about what's going on since then. So the direct causes, what would be the direct causes? I mean, what would we list? We could list a whole bunch of them. I won't put them, write them up, but just throw them out and things that we talked about.
Dependence on cash crops.
Right, the colonial system.
A lot of money in the oil-producing countries.
Right. It's a sort of use of money in...
Bad loans.
Capital flight.
Corruption related to that.
Mm-hmm. High interest rates of the late 70s.
Right.
Well, isn't not to get off subject, but like down in South America, they can make so much more raising drugs that they've got away from other cash crops too.
That's an interesting issue. I wish we had time to talk about that, but that's exactly right. And you know what they say is in Latin America is the United States is the market. They said if you cut your market, then you wouldn't have the drug problem, but you're coming down here with all this military and you try to shoot everybody up, you know. If you close off the market, then it wouldn't be a problem, but you're right. I mean, people can earn a lot more in Bolivia or Colombia producing.
How does that figure into the economy? Because it's a big economy, but we don't count it because it's not legal. Is that true? I mean, how does that? That is money traveling back and forth and all kinds of stuff going on, too.
Yeah, I don't know. I mean, it's still counted into most equations, I think. I'm not sure, frankly. I don't really know about that.
I would doubt that they would recirculate that money in their own country. They'd probably put it in Swiss banks.
Oh, yeah. I mean, the people are really, it's the same thing. Yeah, I mean, that's absolutely right.
And be even more there because they're trying to hide the money.
But they're trying to what?
They're trying to launder the money or hide it. Or I guess maybe there isn't.
Yeah. I know some of the stuff about the drug problem. I know a lot about it. And it's sort of, maybe if we have time, we can come back to that.
I have one more question about your graph there with the truck. The farmer who's producing the cotton in Tanzania, is he paying interest? Is it a loan to him personally that he's taken out to get his field of cotton going?
Is this his
own personal problem?
I mean, it could be that someone, but most likely an individual farmer is going to take a loan out internally.
Uh-huh.
This is not so much an example of one particular farmer having an external debt. It's more to show just simply the balance of trade.
Okay.
In terms of saying that in the country of Tanzania, it takes four times more production of cotton to buy the same truck than it did in 5 years earlier.
But the people who have the outstanding loans and are paying the interest and stuff are really the banks or the big corporations or something. They're not the individual farmers.
In the third world,
yeah,
you mean?
Yeah, in the third world.
A lot of it's going to be the government itself.
Uh-huh.
A lot of it will be private businesses who have borrowed money to, for various reasons, to expand their factories to for a particular project. There are not going to be very many individuals. I mean, there will be very, very wealthy elite that may have borrowed money to invest in certain things. But yeah, and a lot of the factories are going to be owned by individuals. But it won't be a small farmer.
Not the peasants.
Yeah. Other direct causes would be just the development models that we talked about of pouring a lot of money into large development projects. Militarization, which has been a factor in all of this. Oil prices, commodity prices, I think we've probably covered most of. Okay, so who's responsible? Who would you say is responsible for the debt?
Well, the promoters, I suppose.
You mean the bank, the bankers?
People who entice the people. I suppose if a person suddenly has a lot of money to spend, it's probably easy to spend it unwisely.
Other opinions or other additions to that? Might not be just one person or one group.
Well, there's a desire in the third world, and it certainly was manifested in the late 1970s, to modernize.
Mm-hmm.
And when they had the opportunity to get cheap money, Here was the you know, the pot of gold,
right?
And this was going to be the opportunity to electrize, you know, electricity to your country and pave your roads and fix your water supply systems, and you know, this then there you can't fault that desire.
Mm-hmm.
But
it does, I think you're right. I mean, I think the third world, that the elites who are making those decisions, I agree. I share responsibility for it.
You'd think that the banks might have wanted a feasibility study done, perhaps, with the atomic plant in the Philippines, for instance. I mean, there must have been a fair amount of knowledge about earthquake faults and all that sort of stuff.
But one would think so.
They were just so anxious to learn it.
Right.
I would think that probably poor management are looking ahead, but I mean, we was down in Mexico here a few years back, down in Ensenada, and they got this toll road. It's a nice toll road. But there isn't that much traffic on, and they had an overhead, a concrete overhead, which you don't put in, and it just went out to two fields. You know, I mean, obviously they thought that 20 years down the line, there's going to be a housing project out here and one down there. But rather than seeing that it happens, they just built this toll road, and there wasn't that much traffic that you couldn't just run across.
Mm-hmm. No, I think that's...
I mean, that's infrastructure.
This management, know. I think that the elites and the managers and the government folks and in the third world have to share in responsibility. And I also think that it's really clear that the banks themselves have got to take some responsibility. And up until now, that really has not much happened. As well as the governments who loaned at that time or who were supporting and helping to facilitate the loans from banks. Okay, what I want to go into next is explaining a little bit about the IMF, because what's happened since 1982 is that the IMF has become much more involved in trying to deal with the loans, and that's directly related to what the human costs become. But before I do that, I just want to make sure that we're all together, at least to some degree, and everyone has fairly clear understanding of what's happening and haven't fallen asleep yet, then I guess I can't ask for everything. Are there any other questions or just general needs for clarification before we move on? I know this is very fast. I know it's a lot of information, and it's not particularly the most exciting stuff either to listen to alone.
You're doing a great job of making it easy to understand. Yeah. We read about these things in the paper, but have no idea what it really means. So.
Good.
Germany.
Yes.
It would seem that the militarization of any country would have to be really a dead end. I mean, money that goes in there is gone.
It doesn't contribute at all to the economic development.
Right. So is there a correlation between the military development in a country and the degree of debt or its import that's...
I don't have any figures on that, but my guess would be yes. I mean that is part of it. A lot of the loans did go directly to military armament, and a lot of them that were never intended to that were scraped off by military. In other words, the loan might have been for another purpose, but then the military sort of laundered the money to get the money for some military purposes. And I don't think there's any doubt that's a big part of the problem too. Poured into the armaments that don't contribute anything to being able to pay back those loans. Okay, let's go on then to the IMF. In a traditional sense, if you have a loan out, you have debt, and you have to pay this debt back, and you're having real problems, and you have to sort of take a look. Let's say that you have an individual loan, and all of a sudden your income's cut significantly, but you still have this loan you have to pay. I mean, what is going to be the basic strategy in the traditional sense of trying to pay that loan? What are you going to have to do?
Extend it.
Sorry?
Extend it.
Okay, extend it would be one thing.
You could borrow more money from some other source.
Borrow more money. Go bankrupt, that's always a good option here in the States. I can never figure out how people like Frank Lorenzo get to I can't remember what it was, but they get to declare bankruptcy and they're still flying around all the world and living their lives. I don't know how it works, but anyway. Actually, I do have some idea how it works. So extending it, taking out other loans, declaring bankruptcy.
Get a second job.
Get a second job, so you're trying to increase your income, all right? What might you try to do at the same time you're trying to increase income is cut your costs. Okay, well, the IMF, basically in 1982, when all of a sudden everybody woke up to the fact that, hey, we have a problem here, the banks and the governments that were the loaners rallied together and basically put most of the responsibility on the IMF for being their loan collectors, their managers, whatever. Trying to say, you guys handle this problem, we'll stand behind you. So, the third world, the debtors' countries, were caught in a situation where then they really were at the mercy of the IMF. Because they couldn't always pay off their loans on time. The IMF came in and said, basically, I'm representing Citicorp Bank that you've got a $5 billion loan out for. This is oversimplified a little bit, but this is basically what happened. Now, what does the IMF do? They do basically what we just talked about in the individual sense. They instigate what they call adjustment programs, but what most people in the third world call austerity programs. Basically, the idea is to try to increase the net income in dollars. Now, we won't take a lot of time talking about that, but you need to realize that these loans can't be paid off in Salvadoran colones or in pesos or in any other currency. They have to be paid off in dollars because that's the international currency. Now, if you have Swiss francs or German marks or Japanese yen, you're not going to have any problems getting dollars. But if you have, your own third world currency, you can't just pay off the loan. So you've got to get dollars. Right, how do you get dollars?
You have to,
there are various ways. I mean, you get other loans that come in dollars. You can increase your exports. Mm-hmm. That's one of the main parts of it. You have to bring in dollars from the outside by selling something. Other ways is aid, as financial, foreign aid programs, yeah.
Can't you trade your own pesos and go to the bank and trade them in for dollars?
Well, it doesn't really work that way. You can do that if you're a tourist and you want to go down and change to spend, either way, if you're going, everybody always takes your dollars because everybody wants your dollars. But if you're talking about billions and billions of dollars worth of stuff, who in the United States wants who wants $5 billion worth of pesos? It's not going to do you any good because that's not the international exchange currency. You can't buy anything in Europe with pesos, but if you have dollars, you can buy it. Until 1970, gold was the international standard, but then Nixon changed that and became the dollar.
International.
Yeah, it's the main international
dollars.
Yeah.
Is that what it's meant when something's non-convertible, like a ruble?
Right.
Is that something
yeah.
else?
Yeah,
that's what that means. And nobody wants it.
Right. The ruble is not exchanged anywhere in the world.
No value.
Outside of Japan.
But if Mexico owes something to Japan, they pay it in dollars.
Or you?
Well, somebody may know more about that than I do. I mean, if they've got yen, if Mexico has yen for some reason because they've sold something to Japan or whatever, then obviously they can pay it in yen. But dollars is the standard currency, the standard exchange currency.
Okay.